From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. North Carolina is set to launch phase one of its reopening 5 p.m. on Friday, May 8th. There are four major metrics that state officials are watching to see how the COVID-19 pandemic is playing out in the state. These data points, which guide the decision-making about reopening, are the number of hospitalizations for COVID-19, the number of lab-confirmed positive cases, the percentage of positive tests, and the number of emergency room visits from people reporting COVID-like symptoms. All of these metrics are stabilizing or ticking down, according to Mandy Cohen, Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, with one exception. The number of confirmed positive cases is ticking up. But officials say that's to be expected with the recent increase in testing. So what does phase one mean? First, and most importantly, it does not mean that the stay-at-home order is lifted. That order is in place, but modified, giving people more reasons to leave their homes. The designation between essential and non-essential businesses is gone, so stores can reopen at 50% capacity. However, personal care businesses, hair and nail salons, barbers, gyms, entertainment venues, these must remain closed in phase one since social distancing is essentially impossible there. Restaurants are also still banned from dine-in options and must continue takeout business only. We've also just learned from DHHS that more than half of North Carolina adults are at higher risk for severe illness from COVID-19. The reason? The majority of the state's population is 65 or older, has at least one underlying health condition, or fits into both categories. The public policy around the coronavirus restrictions has been controversial. Reopen NC supporters are pushing for an even greater loosening of restrictions. Opponents of reopening worry anew about spikes in positive cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. Joining me now to explore the questions surrounding this next phase, Dr. Paul Kamitska is a hospital epidemiologist at New Hanover Regional Medical Center, and he's infectious diseases consultant for Wilmington Health. Dr. Kamitska, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Lisa Brown is public health preparedness coordinator for New Hanover County, and she also joins us now. Lisa Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Are you eager to see North Carolina reopen? Does the prospect of reopening scare you? Why or why not? Tell us about it with an email on this Wednesday, May 6th at coastline@whqr.org. And of course, we still aren't taking phone calls while I'm broadcasting from home. Lisa Brown, explain to us, first of all, why reopening is phased. What's the logic here?
Sure. So part of the reason for a very deliberate phased approach is that it's going to take a little while before we really see what impact increasing activity has on our case counts and our communities. So it's going to take a week to 3 weeks when we change something before we start to really see, are we seeing a trend of increasing cases? Are we seeing cases occurring in a population that we're concerned about? So it's going to take a little bit. And so part of the reason for being very deliberate and phased is to give those of us that are watching those metrics the time to identify changes and to offer up what is happening in the community before we move to that next step, rather than just changing things immediately and then risking a situation where you might not have time to react or to do those public health measures that you do, the testing and the contact tracing, and to try to mitigate cases. If you go too quickly, then you risk not being able to do those things in a very manageable, controlled way.
And when we hear Secretary Cohen talking about those four metrics that the state is following, how do those metrics, or rather the trends, compare to just New Hanover County's numbers and the southeastern part of the state? Are they basically in line?
I would say overall, yes. We have seen an increase in cases, But as you pointed out, we've also increased testing, so we expect to see an increase in cases. One of the things that we do feel good about is, even though we've seen an increase in cases, that percentage of positive rate is still relatively low. So that is a good sign. And so that's something that goes along with looking at that case count that we're monitoring very closely.
So much of what we understand or don't understand about the infection rate and the transmission of the coronavirus is based on the data that we get from testing. Dr. Paul Kamietzka, help us understand what we know right now and what we really don't know about who has it and who might be immune and if there even is immunity.
Right. So currently, there are two types of testing out there. The first is the diagnostic testing, and that is a molecular test called a PCR test. So if you have symptoms consistent with COVID-19, that's the test that's done, and that will tell you if you have the infection now. The other test, which has not yet been perfected, is the serology test. That's a blood test looking to see if you have evidence of having already had the infection. And I say that it hasn't been perfected yet because the early tests, some of them have been faulty because they cross-react with other coronaviruses. There are four other coronaviruses that cause the common cold that circulate in the United States. And some of the tests will give you a false positive for COVID-19 because of cross-reacting antibodies to these other coronaviruses. But I think that once the tests are improved, we will then be able to do serologic surveys of populations to see what proportion of the population already has been infected. Now, New York has done that with some of the early tests, and for example, found that almost 14% of the state of the sample that they looked at already had evidence of prior virus exposure. In New York City, it was up as high as 20%. It's important to look at that because the phenomenon of so-called herd immunity, which is if enough people already have been infected, that perhaps that will help stop the virus in its tracks because less people are susceptible to getting infected and then transmitting the virus. That only kicks in when you have probably at least 70% of the population already having been infected by the virus. So even in New York City, as bad as the outbreak was or is there, only 20% appear to have had the infection, which means 80% is still vulnerable.
But do we really know that, Dr. Kamietzka, if the antibody tests aren't reliable at this point?
So that's subject to the potential inaccuracies of the test, but that's just sort of a rough guide. The other question that you had raised is, do you have immunity after getting infected to getting reinfected with the virus? And the answer to that is we think so. Based on other coronaviruses, but the duration of that immunity is unknown, and just how complete that immunity is also unknown. With other coronaviruses like the MERS virus, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus, which is a cousin of COVID-19, you may have a year or two of immunity. But that's still very much for this virus an unknown, and we really won't know until we have more data down the road.
How far out do you think an accurate antibody test really is?
Well, I suspect that of the dozens of tests that have been put out, there are some among that group that are more specific for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which causes COVID-19. It's just that we need to have validation to make sure that the test indeed is specific for COVID-19. But I think within the next few weeks, we will have much better information along those lines. So I think it's not far off, but we just need the validation data.
And Lisa Brown, Public Health Preparedness Coordinator with New Hanover County. New Hanover County has expanded its diagnostic testing, and I'll ask you about that in a second, but is there also antibody testing going on in the county?
There's not currently antibody testing going on in the county. The county has been given a donation of antibody tests, but we're in that very early phase of taking a look at those tests, contacting the lab, and trying to figure out how best to move forward. So at this time, there's not antibody tests occurring.
So how best to move forward, because you don't know if the donated tests are going to be valid or accurate, or what are the questions for the county?
I think you just raised some of the questions for the county. So that's going to be part of what we need to understand more fully. These particular tests that were donated, their specificity, if they pick up those other coronaviruses or if they're highly specific to COVID-19. And then we would probably look at doing kind of a phased approach, maybe offering them first to those New Hanover County residents that had that diagnostic, that PCR COVID-19 test. Start there.
Okay, and we're going to learn more about the diagnostic testing that's going on in the region when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline, and hopefully you're learning too. Lisa Brown of New Hanover County and Dr. Paul Kamitska of NHRMC are with us today, helping us understand the next phase of dealing with coronavirus in North Carolina. When we come back from this break, we'll also hear from some listeners. You can ask your own question or tell us how you're dealing with going out in public by sending us an email. The address is coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. As North Carolinians head into phase one of reopening, too soon for some, not fast enough for others, my two guests today are helping us understand the practical realities of safety, testing, and the likely future. Lisa Brown is Public Health Preparedness Coordinator for New Hanover County. Dr. Paul Kamitska is Hospital Epidemiologist at NHRMC and Infectious Diseases Consultant for Wilmington Health. You can ask your own question during this live Wednesday, May 6th discussion, or tell us how you're feeling about this first phase of reopening by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. And Lisa Brown, just before we went to break, was going to ask you about the expansion of diagnostic testing in New Hanover County, which just started recently. How is that going, and what are you seeing?
Sure. So one thing to clarify, it spoke to antibody testing in the county, and the county hadn't yet begun doing antibody testing, but I did want to clarify that doesn't mean that we don't have any private providers in the region that are doing antibody testing. That could be occurring separately.
Okay, but that's also something, but just to be clear, we do still have big questions around the efficacy of those tests, and is the county tracking those numbers?
We're not tracking antibody testing numbers at this point. That might be something that we look into a little bit later on, but currently we don't have visibility on how many in our region have been tested for antibodies. On the diagnostic testing piece, that expanded testing that we're doing to actually diagnose the COVID-19, we did recently begin an expanded effort. So part of how that process works is we had set up through our call center, the coronavirus call center for the county. If somebody is experiencing symptoms, then they go ahead and they call and we get them pre-screened. And so as part of that screening process, then they're given an appointment time to show up at our mobile testing site. So that is an open air, drive-through testing site that we have established that began operating last week. And it features a drive-through option where you can literally stay in your car. And it's been working out that it's been very efficient, as little as 2 minutes once inside that gate. But we also have an option for anyone that is on foot or on bike, where they can also go to a tent and get tested there. Last week, we tested 191 people through that site. And the results were very good as far as how the process worked and the efficiency. It seemed to be very smooth. And so far out of that site, we had received 5 positive results. So that's something that we're also reporting out regularly as we get that information back.
And just out of curiosity, are the positive results, do you differentiate between people who are asymptomatic and people who are showing symptoms? Or is it likely that most people who go to the drive-up testing site already have symptoms? That's why they're calling and getting an appointment.
So far, it's been limited to symptomatic individuals only. So that those numbers are strictly those that had symptoms for coronavirus. Moving forward, we're having discussions, though, about possibly opening that up on a limited basis to those that are close contacts to somebody that was a confirmed case. We have some concerns, though, obviously, about testing asymptomatic individuals through that, as we don't want to give false negatives. So by that, I mean, we're worried that if somebody goes through that site and they didn't have symptoms and their test is negative, that may not necessarily mean they don't have COVID-19. It might mean that they didn't have enough of the virus yet to be picked up through that diagnostic test. So that's part of why we've been very, very cautious in limiting that to symptomatic or somebody that's very closely connected, identified as a close contact to a symptomatic case that was diagnosed.
WFAE, which is an NPR member station in Charlotte, North Carolina, has been looking at testing in North Carolina and reported recently North Carolina now ranks 45th out of 50 states when it comes to testing. South Carolina, they report, is even worse. South Carolina is second to last. Dr. Kamitska, what prevents much broader testing in North Carolina? Is it money, the supply chain? Is it going to get better?
Well, I think until very recently, it was just access to testing. We really did not have access to testing, so we had to pretty much restrict it to people who had a high probability of actually having COVID-19. That fortunately has improved greatly so that we now have much greater testing capability. And coincident with that has been the broadening of the criteria for testing. Initially, we were testing only people with fever and lower respiratory symptoms like cough or shortness of breath, particularly those who had some other epidemiologic exposure potential such as travel. But now the definition CDC last week revised the potential symptoms for COVID-19 to include other symptoms, things such as chills, muscle aches and joint aches, vomiting, diarrhea, sore throat, and headache. And so now when we are interviewing patients in terms of could they have symptoms of COVID-19, we will test people who have any of those symptoms. So the net is much broader in terms of who we test, and the supply of testing now is much better with a much faster turnaround time. In the past, we were waiting a week or so before we were getting results back. Now we have tests that will give us a result typically within 24 hours, or we do have for hospitalized patients a rapid return test, which will give us a result within 50 minutes.
What about congregate living facilities, assisted living, nursing homes? Is there extra testing going on there? Would there need to be? What's the policy right now?
Well, that's a very good question, because any congregate living situation, whether it be a nursing facility or prisons, are high risk environments for spread of COVID-19. And then in the nursing facility environment, of course, you have predominantly elderly or debilitated patients who would also be at highest risk for adverse consequences from COVID infection. So yes, we are looking very closely at those facilities. Right now, when we are discharging patients, for example, from New Hanover Hospital to one of those facilities, the patients are tested just to make sure that as much as we can, that in fact the patient is not infected or contagious. But part of the problem there is something Lisa was mentioning. If the patient truly has no symptoms, none of the above stated symptoms, then the sensitivity of the PCR test goes way down. So that even with a negative test, you can't be totally reassured that a person doesn't have COVID-19. So we encourage everybody to sort of stay alert to any of the symptoms, potential symptoms of COVID-19. Now, once symptoms arise, then the test becomes much more accurate.
So then what you're saying is we really have no idea how many people might be asymptomatic carriers of this virus.
We don't. The only way that you would know is to test a lot of people, including those who don't have any symptoms, with a test that is sensitive enough to pick them up. For the truly asymptomatic patients, the current tests just aren't sensitive enough to be able to do that. Much of the data in terms of asymptomatic carriage has come from patients who did not have symptoms at time A, but then subsequently developed them. And in retrospect, they would have been infected even at an earlier time point.
Right. Okay. So we need to get into a discussion about masks. And I have people emailing asking about this. You're listening to Coastline. North Carolina is poised to launch phase one of its reopening. We have two public health officials with us today to answer questions about testing and best practices when venturing out. Dr. Paul Kamitska is hospital epidemiologist at NHRMC and infectious diseases consultant at Wilmington Health. Lisa Brown is public health preparedness coordinator for New Hanover County. And they're answering your questions during the live discussion on Wednesday, May 6th. You can ask a question or tell us, are you wearing a mask when you go out? Gloves, why or why not? Send your email to coastline@whqr.org. And Michelle writes, I'm trying to convince elderly relatives that they must wear a mask when they go out. They resist, she says, and maintain that it's safer not to have one. How do I convince them? I've gotten so many questions about masks. And, you know, early on, the CDC advised no masks. Then they advised everyone wear masks when they go out in public. And there was the understanding that masks protect people from the wearer, but they don't really protect the wearer of the mask. Is that still true, Dr. Kamitska?
Yes, that is true. And so that the only way we can really have protection wearing masks is if everybody does wear a mask. And so we encourage everybody to do that. When you leave the home, wear a mask. The predominant role of the mask is what we call source control. And so all of us, when we talk or cough or sneeze, we expel droplets, and the mask catches those. So we protect others from us. But if everybody's wearing a mask, then we protect each other. So this is one of those situations where it really does need to be a group effort to keep all of us safe.
And so when you, grocery stores are one of those places, right? You know, they have been an essential business. They've had to remain open. Employees have had to deal with different policies depending on the grocery store chain that they work for. And there aren't that many chains that have instituted policies that require customers to wear a mask before they're allowed in the store. Costco started that on Monday. I believe that's a policy for the Fresh Market. Other stores encourage social distancing, even say that they invite people to practice it. Many of them do require their employees to wear masks, but how effective or does that really matter when an employee is, say, behind the deli counter and not getting within six feet of customers, or behind the meat department counter in the butcher department? Does it matter? Dr. Kamitska?
Yes. I think in terms of wearing a mask in those circumstances, if there's a great deal of distance between the employee and the customer, probably not. But the appearance of employees wearing masks really does send a very good message that this retail establishment is taking very seriously the social distancing that is so necessary to prevent the spread of COVID-19. You mentioned Costco. I shopped there about a week ago, and I was quite impressed, really. They wiped down the handles of the shopping cart between customers. They have markings which clearly designate 6 feet separation. There are posters up, there's hand sanitizer, and now they're wearing masks. So I think they are really a role model for all retail establishments in terms of how we should be approaching COVID-19. Again, it's a group effort. It's an all hands on deck type situation. So I would strongly encourage all retail establishments to follow suit.
And I don't mean to beat the same drum, but there has been a lot of confusion, especially in debates on social media, when some people will say, really don't appreciate seeing people go out to the grocery store without masks. And then other people will say, hey, it's your choice to wear a mask. If you don't feel safe, stay in. But I think the assumption there is that the mask is protecting the wearer of the mask. Why is the mask not necessarily protective for the person wearing it?
Well, the reason is that the masks, particularly cloth masks, they don't fully, they're not good enough to fully contain all of the respiratory droplets that may be expelled from a person's mouth as they're talking or coughing or sneezing. So it's partially protective, but some particles still do get through. And so it's still worth doing, again, for the reasons of source control, because it does catch a lot of those droplets, but it's not foolproof. And so that's why if all of us wear masks, we're gonna be able to protect each other. I think the way to think about masks is that if everybody does it, we protect each other. Not absolutely, but probably to a significant extent.
Lisa Brown of New Hanover County, is there anything that you'd like to say before we leave the topic of masks to people who either, you know, are forced to wear them by their employer and so they pull them down onto their chin, not covering nose and mouth, or for people who do venture out into public spaces and say, I feel fine. I'm not going to wear a mask. If you want to wear a mask, that's your prerogative, but I don't want to be bothered. Anything you'd like to say?
I would just reinforce what was shared, and even that situation you shared, if you have somebody that's not closely interacting with the public, and maybe it's more than 6 feet in say that grocery store, but does that person interact with other staff members? Are there possibly other people that could be exposed? So in addition to their interaction with the public, you also have to think about, is there a possibility of transmission happening in that place of employment? The more COVID-19 that we have just in the community, the more it's allowed to spread, then the harder it becomes to keep it out of those really vulnerable populations. You know, we talked about the long-term care facilities, and there are a lot of measures that are in place, wearing masks by the staff members being one of them, and that increased testing. But the more that we allow it to spread in the community, the harder it will become to keep it out of those vulnerable environments. So that's why it's really important that if you're not worried about your own personal health or that you are at risk, to keep in mind when you're wearing that mask, you are helping protect everybody in the community. That is just so important to understand.
And it's probably hard for some people who haven't been personally touched by this to really take this in beyond the abstract, but people need to think of themselves as carriers of the virus. Is that fair?
Right. That's right. You know, any of us could potentially be carriers of the virus. So it's really sort of like the golden rule of COVID-19 prevention. Do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. That's why we wear masks. And if all of us do that, all of us do the social distancing and hygiene and disinfecting touch surfaces, then we help each other. And that's how we get through the pandemic as unscathed as possible.
Chris writes, does New Hanover County have a plan to reverse the phases when the second wave becomes more severe? And of course, we're hearing all kinds of different scenarios, and a lot of them are pretty grim. But Lisa Brown, where is the state and the county? I'll actually let you answer that when we come back from this break about being nimble in response to the numbers. You're listening to Coastline. Dr. Paul Kamitska, epidemiologist, and Lisa Brown, New Hanover County's public health preparedness coordinator, are with us today and answering your questions on this Wednesday, May 6th. You can ask a question or tell us how you're dealing with the coronavirus restrictions by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more from listeners. It's also the last segment, so you have just a few minutes left to get your own question or comment in during the live Wednesday discussion. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, it's a look at mask protocols in the coronavirus age, how North Carolina is dealing with testing, and what public health officials say are best practices for getting out and about a little bit more in the coming days. Lisa Brown is Public Health Preparedness Coordinator for New Hanover County. Dr. Paul Kamitska is Hospital Epidemiologist for New Hanover Regional Medical Center and Infectious Diseases Consultant for Wilmington Health. We are live on this Wednesday, May 6th. If you have questions, you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your questions or comments in. Lisa Brown, how is New Hanover County looking at the numbers? And obviously, there are some people like Chris who just emailed concerned about a second wave that's severe.
Absolutely. And that was a major reason behind the county effort to expand the availability of testing. And that's by no means all of the testing that's happening in the county. That was just building on what was already available through private providers, expanding that availability throughout the county so that we were sure we weren't missing anyone that might not have insurance or have access to a provider, to kind of make sure that that gap was filled moving forward and that we had really good data, because that has been critical from the beginning, is looking at the available information and offering that to make decisions. We have been very, very fortunate in New Hanover County that we have a very strong planning community. So with our emergency management partners, our business community, those long-term care providers, all of those individual providers in the hospital, that we all work together very closely behind the scenes regularly. So part of what we had done back in the fall when we had done that mass vaccination exercise, we were actually practicing our ability to distribute medications or vaccine in a pandemic. And it was that groundwork of working with the hospital was one of our partners in putting on that exercise and that practice run. But it was that plan that we then adapted to be able to do this sort of drive-through expanded testing site. So it's very much the groundwork and the partners behind the scene working together throughout this and sharing information, I think, that has put our county in a very good position. Our population density and our tourism, we have some vulnerabilities. We have a lot of travel back and forth that make it so that something like COVID-19, a communicable disease that doesn't honor county boundaries, has the opportunity to spread. And yet I feel like we have done an excellent job in the region of really keeping our case count relatively low and communicating to our partners and working to keep at least our local environment very good. And that's going to be definitely something we're moving forward and monitoring, not just what's happening in New Hanover County, but what's happening in our neighboring counties as we make recommendations as far as moving forward, or if we have some concerns that we're seeing spikes in cases, that we're not able to do the contact tracing that needs to be done as quickly as it needs to be done. And we'll be communicating that and sharing those concerns. And I know the hospital as well, and the metrics that they measure, and sharing any concerns that they have as we progress.
Okay. And just that, the contact tracing, can you just explain what that is? Just yesterday at the Tuesday news briefing with the governor and Department of Health and Human Services, Mandy Cohen, they talked about the hiring that's going on for that program around the state. How does that work? What is it?
Sure. So contact tracing is actually not a new thing. That's a pretty old public health tool. And what that means is that basically if somebody has COVID-19, then it's following up with that individual with a public health nurse and having that conversation about who have you potentially been in close contact with. And we use that CDC definition of within 6 feet for 10 minutes and following up to see where they might have been. And then there's a separate process where a public health nurse would reach out to folks that have been identified as close contacts. Again, not revealing who their close contact was or who had been diagnosed, but just making them aware that they are potentially exposed to COVID-19, that they finding out if they themselves might have symptoms and connecting them to testing and making sure that they know how to monitor their health, what to watch for, but also so that then they are taking those precautions so that they don't risk potentially infecting someone else, especially knowing that individuals can be asymptomatic. That step is really important to help to intervene before one case becomes multiple cases.
Right, and as you and Dr. Kamitska have made clear today, we all need to assume that we're carriers of the virus, but asymptomatic if we're healthy. Right. I mean, that's something everybody needs to assume. Stat News is a health and medicine focused publication of Boston Globe Media, and they published a piece recently about three possible outcomes here. And I know everybody's talking about projections. There were some really grim projections that were taken from a Johns Hopkins researcher, I guess, and he said that was kind of half-baked and perhaps not entirely accurate yet, but this piece has three scenarios. The first, a monster wave of cases hits in early 2020, what we're going through now. That's followed by alternating mini waves of smaller outbreaks every few months. The second scenario has the current monster wave followed by one twice as fierce later this summer and longer lasting. And then in the third potential future, the current wave creates a new normal with outbreaks of nearly equal size through the end of 2022, which at that point they say an effective vaccine has arrived. The common thread here, all three scenarios agree there's no chance that COVID-19 is ending this year. Dr. Kamitska, do you have an estimate for when North Carolina cases will peak?
I really don't. There are different models that are out there that look at this issue. But it all depends on the assumptions that you use when putting together your model. And for example, the University of Washington model that has been used, for example, by the White House, one of the most conservative models, underestimating in general, compared to other models, the number of cases, expected cases, had predicted that we've already been past our peak. So I think it all is going to depend on how well people socially distance as various districts will increase the freedom of mobility and opening up retail stores. So we can't really say for sure based on where we are right now. We just have to keep a close eye on it.
Sure. And as we think about reopening this weekend, and, you know, some beaches were reopened last weekend, and I've heard anecdotal concerns. Ed writes, I'm a primary care provider, continue to see patients in my office and hospital. I go nowhere without a mask. He says, I have isolated away from my family for the past 5 to 6 weeks. After what I saw at one of our beach communities this weekend, I think we're fooling ourselves that the majority of the public is taking the appropriate precautions to prevent a second wave of COVID-19 infections. It's very discouraging, he says. How should we be behaving at the beaches where there's sunshine and fresh air and seawater? It seems like the perfect cleansing of a virus, Dr. Kamitska. What do we need to do there?
Yes. So I am all for people getting out to the beach. But if you do so, you have to socially distance. And the real enemy of that we're having to contend with is crowding. Anytime you have crowding without social distancing, that is a threat. And all of us will need to sort of educate ourselves on how do we re-engage in those activities that we enjoyed before in a safe manner. And, you know, for example, last weekend in our neighborhood, we had a cocktail party, and we got deck chairs that were separated by at least 6 feet. Everybody brought their own beverages so that there was no sharing. And also their own hand sanitizer. We had a marvelous time, but it was in a safe, socially distanced manner. Same thing at the beach. It's fine to go to the beach, but you've got to keep your distance and preferably wear a mask and have some hand sanitizer to disinfect hands if you touch surfaces. If you do all that, it should be fine. But therein lies the problem, is that people tend to forget the importance of social distancing and thereby make things like going to the beach unsafe.
And this raises the question about people on the front lines in the summer. Part of that contingent will be lifeguards. What happens when a lifeguard has to swim out to someone in distress? Is he or she putting their own life at risk? Are we going to have waterproof masks for lifeguards? What kind of protocols should be put in place for that scenario?
Well, that is a consideration, because they have no choice but to not socially distance. In terms of are there options for some sort of masking that could be used in seawater, that's something that would need to be addressed.
We have a question. Robert writes, a friend of mine sent me a YouTube link to a piece called Pandemic Part One, which was an interview with somebody who's written a book, makes serious accusations against, among others, Dr. Fauci, Bill Gates, pharmaceutical companies, universities, government agencies for hiding the truth about virus treatment and blatant attempts at pushing vaccines they own the patents to. Can either of you respond to the credibility of this widespread information? And can you also just speak to how this is getting politicized?
Lisa, do you want to take that one?
Take the political question, Lisa.
I would say not to address the political question, but throughout this, making sure that accurate information is what is being shared, that it is scientific information, data-driven information, has been a challenge. That is something that I know our communications team has worked very hard on, and I would imagine is communications teams throughout the county and all across the country, to make sure that the information that we're sharing is the best available, accurate information and dispelling rumors and myths.
Someone writes, would love to know if the experts think North Carolina will ever be in the position of testing every person in the state. Is that on the way?
I know that the state of North Carolina is actively talking through plans to increase testing. I don't know that we would be to that point. But I know that there are a lot of efforts underway to really ramp up the availability of testing statewide. And I would say also the important thing to keep in mind is not just a point in time testing, so not just a raw number, but testing is going to be important throughout the time that we deal with COVID-19, so on a regular ongoing basis as well.
Elizabeth asks, why isn't it the law that everyone is required to wear a mask when they enter a store? Why can't it be required instead of merely recommended? Lisa Brown.
Well, that's an interesting question. So that's definitely been the recommendation. I would leave that to the legislators to address if that's something that they would consider making a law of. But I would say from a public health perspective, it is definitely our recommendation that everyone wear a mask.
Right. And Wayne asks about meatpacking. He asks, can COVID-19 be transmitted from infected workers to the meat products we bring home? Dr. Kamitska.
Yeah, I think that would be unlikely. And particularly when the virus is on surfaces, it only survives for a finite period of time. So that by the time you purchase it at the grocery store and it gets processed, even if there was active virus, it may no longer be viable. Plus then you cook it. So I think there are safeguards there. The real problem with meatpacking plants is more just spread among the workers because they're not able to distance effectively within the meatpacking plant. But I think as customers, as consumers, we are at very low risk from that.
And of course, restaurants are still doing takeout business only. There's no dine-in. But Dr. Kamitska, you have some pretty strong ideas about how the new normal needs to be when they do finally allow dine-in customers. Can you just give us a couple of those points? We'd have about a minute left. Dr. Kamitska, are you there? Did we lose you? I think we may have lost Dr. Kamitska. Lisa Brown, I know that, as you said, this is phase one and we're being so careful, but what is it that you'd really like people to take with them from today's discussion?
My hope would be that we take the message that we are all in this together and we are all protecting each other. So those measures that we keep talking about, the wearing the mask, the hand washing, the using the hand sanitizer, that those are steps to protect ourselves, but also our entire community moving forward.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Lisa Brown, Dr. Paul Kamitska, thank you both for being with us today. Coastline's production team includes Rachel Keith and Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast. Find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.